Hello and welcome to the Zach Think Share podcast as I share what I'm thinking about. And today we're joined by Professor Neil Sheminsky. I say that right?
Yep.
Neil, I've been following you for somewhere around a year. I think we were tagged in something together. And pretty much whenever that happens, I'm like, I think this is probably a good person I should be friends with. And I think you and I have DM'd for a handful of months. I've noticed my other content creator friends is like, whenever one of our videos goes sideways, sometimes we're like, we're the first ones there for support. It's like, ooh, they're eating you alive in the comments. Hang in there. Like, I think I often appreciate the challenges of being a content creator. So I've been a big fan of what you've been creating because I think you call out the manosphere, as you like to call it, on like the toxic masculine sort of habits and things that they say. But better part of what you said, like I could probably do that. But what I'm not capable of doing is using the level of academic jargon and delivery in such a way that it's accessible. I suck at that. One, I just don't have... I don't have some of the academic language, I think, to describe the things. And I feel like I get significantly smarter listening to you. You also, I feel like one, because you're an actual like college professor and like, I think generally you don't mind going into the weeds and like looking at studies and stuff. I can't be bothered with that a lot of times. And so a ton of my content is much more in personal experience rather than digging into some data. So I really appreciate you for bring up these things and making thoughts and ideas accessible. Like the video that I was thinking of the other day was, you were calling out, I think it was like a, probably a Christian leaning thing where they were talking about the amount of partners screws with like the ability to have children. And you're like, yes. No, there's just no evidence to back this up. So I feel like you're defending things that like, if I saw that, I'd be like, that doesn't feel right, but I have no language to back it up. So thank you for the service you're doing out there. And let me ask you this is what is it? I'm sure it's fun for you, but like, mm-hmm. Is there like a driving either ethical or moral or just like, what's the force behind that, that gets you going on it?
Well, it's not just one thing, right? I mean, part of it is anytime I hear misinformation, especially misinformation that is expressed as confidently as it is by some of these men in the manosphere, I have that knee-jerk reaction to, you know, at first, like you were describing, say, that doesn't sound quite right. But then because they have entered into my professional sandbox, I can very quickly step beyond, that doesn't sound quite right, to I'm sure that it'll take me 3 minutes to find the actual information here, to find the correct data, to find even maybe the source. Because often, you know, there is one source that they're relying on when they say, you know, a recent study said, and okay, I'm going to go find that. I'm going to see who wrote it. I'm going to see who published it. What is it that they were studying? And is what we're hearing right now a fair representation of that study or that research? Or is it a distortion? You know, sometimes they'll say studies say, and then I look it up and it's like, this is a study on mice. You would be shocked at how frequently that happens. It's like, you didn't say that this was lab animals. So part of it is just that drive as somebody who works in this field, who feels that, no, if you're going to share information from our field, you should be getting it right. But there is also that moral imperative, where it's, you know, I want the world to be better than what it is right now. I want people to be their best selves. I want us to privilege empathy and kindness. And here we have an entire online community that seems very much aimed at making people angry, stoking their rage, encouraging them to act, you know, only in their own self-interest. And so I also feel a very strong need to undermine their mission. You know, not just promote empathy and kindness and love and care for one another, but also to reveal that, you know, the emperor has no clothing. These men do not know what they speak of.
It's super fun just watching the level that you're able to like tear them apart, what looks like quite effortlessly. One with like the 3-minute Google search, which I'm sure you've gotten increasingly efficient at, but the words you're able to use to describe like the mishits. I feel like one of my greatest hits of watching you was the canned pumpkin guy. And the only frustrating part I find about your videos is that you don't tag like the original creator in it. And cause I know I always want to look that person up, watch their whole clip and just like experience like the, I feel like in our culture, like we love watching stuff like for rage porn. We just love watching like the whole thing so we can feel pissed off about it. Cause it feels a little bit good to be angry at something. Why is it that you don't tag the original creators and things?
So there are actually two reasons for this. One of them is entirely self-serving, which is when I have tagged the original creators in the past, I did do that originally. It made it very easy, especially if they had a strong following themselves, for them to flood my videos with comments from their followers. Would make the comments incredibly unpleasant spaces for the people that followed me. So I felt, you know,
I had not considered that.
Yeah, there were videos where, you know, I would spend half an hour just blocking people. Incredibly unpleasant. You know, and so you do lose something. You lose access to the original. For people who like to be certain that I'm actually representing the people I'm responding to fairly, I can appreciate why they would feel that's a loss too. But it just did not seem worth it to invite that sort of response. Mm. The other reason for it too.
I'm going to guess this one real quick to see if I'm right. Cause I thought this was going to be a reason one, which is like, you know, I think sometimes you're probably going to be the bigger creator. And by putting a spotlight on someone that's putting out crappy information, you're actually like the amount of press Andrew Tate got from people disagreeing with him. Actually, he just like soaked up all the attention from that. Is that reason two?
That's part of it. It's the traffic that they get, right? And that traffic can benefit them, because, you know, as you're describing, you know, the algorithm doesn't discriminate between whether we are paying attention to somebody because we love them or we hate them. So they could get a boost in that way. The other reason that, you know, the traffic can be a problem, though, is that it can actually, especially in cases where the person I'm responding to, I think, you know, sometimes they're well-intentioned. Sometimes, don't get me wrong, they are just evil. But other times it's somebody who is coming from a place of wanting to be helpful and they're misinformed or, you know, their own ideological biases seem to be interfering with their ability to interpret the information. I have a large enough following that I have received messages from people who say, hey, look, people have found me from your video. This is really upsetting. People are leaving hate messages. They're saying, you know, in one instance, I had somebody who's saying, they keep on telling me that they hope my girlfriend leaves me. And she's upset now. So I'm also trying to account for the fact that, you know, once somebody watches my video, I don't have any control over what they do next. Hmm. And some people will make it a mission to go and find the person that I am stitching and let them know just how much they despise them. And that is much more difficult if I'm not giving you their name, I am not giving you a link to the video. And I do want to be mindful of that. You know, I think there's a reason why Dan McClellan, who also makes response videos, he actually has a message at the beginning of every response video that he makes where he says, do not harass this creator. So specifically putting the call out there to say, look, I am not calling on anyone to dogpile. My goal here is not to start a wave against this person, no matter, you know, how misinformed we think they may be. So that's not my objective. And I'd like to keep us focused on, okay, like what are they saying here? What sort of harmful messages are they putting out there into the ether without necessarily drawing attention to the creator themselves?
When it comes to those like really crappy comment sections that people have dogpiled back onto you, have you noticed that it's more on TikTok versus Instagram?
More recently, it is certainly more common on Instagram. I simply get more comments on Instagram. It, you know what? One thing that I like quite a lot about comments on Instagram is that it's very clear that in the first couple of hours, Instagram is showing my videos almost exclusively to people that already follow me.
Yeah.
So I know in those first couple of hours that I'm going to enjoy reading the comments.
Yeah.
After that, it, who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, the volume of comments is just so much greater on Instagram that it's much more likely to happen.
The thing I always kind of go back on, because similarly, I try to be mindful, I think, of like when I'm kind of talking shit about somebody or like, you know, calling them out on what they have to say. Like recently there was this creator, she pretty much said, you know, I'm just going to say it that, you know, being a working mom isn't that hard. Like being a stay-at-home mom is not that hard. And she's like 6 months postpartum. And I didn't do the disclaimer at the beginning. I'm looking back now that you've presented that idea. I think I wish I would have, but I did say at the very end, cause you know, I think I share a pretty significant amount of my own life enough that, people are happy to pigpile on me, and on my wife. And, I said as a disclaimer at the end, I was like, I look forward to their follow-up video. I think most content creators a good content creator, I think, is happy to eat crow when they recognize that, you know, maybe the message landed flat or it just wasn't heard or wasn't received well, or, you know, they recognize they use some language that they wish they could take back. I also try, I've done it a little bit differently now with, cause Alyssa started making a couple of videos and she's felt the courage to join social media. I know I have probably tougher skin than her cause I've made somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 videos since 2016. And I've gotten a significant amount of, a lot of homophobic stuff actually back on YouTube in the day, a couple of videos talking about having a pride flag in my classroom. But I've slowly, one of the ideas I had was I always wanted to post things that I would just either stand by or acknowledge that I made a mistake, but keep the video up. And I'm curious, have you ever found yourself making a video and you've really debated whether to take it down? And like, what's your thought process around moments like that?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. In fact, I took a video down, I think it was just yesterday, because somebody messaged me to say that that I got a detail wrong. It was a video about the female body's immunoresponse to the presence of sperm.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I was responding to a video where somebody greatly exaggerated that response. And I pushed too hard in the opposing direction, and made it sound as if there is no immunoresponse whatsoever. So my language was not just unclear. Like I watched it again. I'm like, oh, I completely misspoke. That detail, it does sound like I am saying there is no such thing as an immunoresponse. That's just wrong. So I've removed that video from TikTok. I don't think I removed it from Instagram, but I probably should, because I don't want misinformation out there. Now, when I do that, and you know, it happens somewhere between, I'd guess, 5 and 10 times a year, where I go back and I'm like, this is just not like it's not up to the standard that I want to hold myself to. There have been times where I would then post something to explain or to clarify. The problem there, and I realized this once with a video that went viral, where it was pointed out that I had made a joke, and this was a joke about a Marvel movie. But, you know, context being what it is, and, you know, this video is watched by a million people who, most of whom, have maybe never even seen my face before because I don't have a million followers. The sarcasm was not hitting right with large numbers of the people that watched it. And so when I was making a sarcastic point about a woman in the movie who was given so little to do that if you had replaced her with a houseplant, nobody would have noticed. That was interpreted in a very sincere way to say, oh, so you're calling her useless. You think this woman is useless. Like, how dare you?
Versus you are actually calling out maybe the filmmakers and the way that they cast the character and the way that they should have been based on the comic books and saying, look, this lady has value. The way that they cast it, the way that they shot it and directed it and edited
and
it.
And the way that her character is written. She was simply not doing anything. Frequently, she was just on screen to be there. And it's just like, this is, I meant this as a criticism of the writing, but not reading my sarcasm as sarcasm. I can absolutely see how somebody, especially if they feel some great affinity for this character, for this movie, I can see how somebody would perceive that as an attack. Now, I made a follow-up video where I apologized for being flippant, because like whether or not you perceive the sarcasm, it certainly did sound very flip. But what that served to do was call more attention to the original video, which upset more people. And so from that point forward, I decided that where in situations where I felt...
Daddy, I want one. Oh, hello.
I want one.
Thank you for the toothbrush, Everly. Do you want to say hi? Oh, thank you. Do you want to say hi?
No.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah, more.
Bye-bye, honey.
I'm going to enter that phase again. I thought I was, I thought I left it behind years ago. But I have a 15-year-old, and I have another one on the way now.
I saw was that meant to be direct? Was the one where the shirts were like puffing out too far? Was that like meant to be mostly like a pregnancy announcement video?
Oh yes. Yeah. That was our friends online already knew, you know, my, I'm in a content creator Discord. Everybody there had already found out, but I thought, you know, let's do a cute little public facing video too.
A content creator Discord. So you're, do you shoot the shit on the regular with a couple of other content creators, almost like this, but in a more passive way?
Yeah. So it's largely the most active people actually are academic content creators, academic and other professionals, you know, so professors, psychologists, lawyers. That wasn't even by design. It just happens that, you know, those are the people who are the most active, and it's a nice place to complain.
Hmm.
You need those venues, right? I think that the recent topic that we were all ranting about was, you know, you post something about a given phenomenon, and so here the inspiration for this conversation was a video that I made where I was talking about gym culture and bodybuilding,
mm-hmm.
As being having very close ties to patriarchy. You know, that bodybuilding as a practice promotes male homosocial bonds that by design were intended to exclude women. And I had somebody message me to say, you know what? I generally love your videos. I think that your points are spot on, but I'm a bodybuilder, heavily involved in gym culture, and this just doesn't reflect my experience. And so the discussion that we were having in this Discord is like, what is up with the people who are like, you know what? My specific experience is not reflected in what you describe, and so therefore, you're wrong.
Hmm.
Which is just it's a frustrating piece of feedback to get. And it's like, well, yeah, it's any individual person's personal experience certainly could deviate from a larger social phenomenon. But your personal experience doesn't necessarily invalidate what has been a culture that has existed for over a century, you know, a practice that has existed for 100 years. And I don't want to say I'm sorry, because actually, if that doesn't reflect your experience, if you've had a far more positive, inclusive experience, that's awesome. Yeah. Very happy for you. That does not mean that your experience is reflective of gym culture as a whole, though, which, you know, I would hope that you have seen videos on platforms like Instagram or TikTok that show you are actually quite hostile to women in a variety of ways and are like very toxically masculine spaces in a lot of ways, too. But I feel like I've gone off on this whole aside now. But it's nice to have those spaces where, yeah, passively I can be like, oh, my God, what is up with people who post these comments? And the very first response was somebody who has about twice the number of followers I have, who's like, oh, dude, it's only going to get worse. It's like the larger you're following, the more people who are like, you know, I think you're wrong because I haven't personally seen it.
Yeah. I want to pivot for a second because, sure. So Alyssa and I'm kind of ashamed to say that it took till January this year to watch Barbie for the first time. We watched it again last night for Valentine's Day. And I think it was, one, I wish I had watched it all the way back in last July when it came out. There's just so much content I probably would have made out of it. Now it just feels like it's not nearly as topical. But I'm really curious as to what your take is on kind of the experience that Ken goes through in the movie. Because this definitely, there are a lot of moments where like, I'm like trying to trace the jargon of like patriarchy. And I think you understand it on a better, like more in-depth level than I do, honestly. I know that I'm pretty sure I can pretty closely quote that part that Barbie says when they like come to the conclusion after, after America's like monologue mid movie. And she's like, if we call out the cognitive dissonance of what it is to be a woman inside the patriarchy, we take its power away. I think I actually understood that. I can like that sunk in. What I can't and still struggle to put together is when, you know, Will Ferrell, they catch up to them in Barbie Land and they've just reset the Constitution. And all of a sudden Ken finds out like, oh damn, like this, Kenland Kingdom has broken, and Barbie's kind of letting him down and he's having this like kind of childish fit. And she's like, well, who are you? Like, you don't have to be without me. And he's like, Ken is me. And it's like, he has this like identity crisis. And then he goes into like an identity shift slash like understand who and what he is. And that part, I'm still struggling with what he actually figured out in that moment. And I'm curious, like how, if you had to describe the, how he identifies himself after that conversation, when he goes from super disempowered, struggling with his own existence, to like pretty happy to be alive. What do you think the transformation is he goes through in those minutes?
You know, I don't think we get a really satisfying resolution with Ken's character. And I suspect that that is the point. Because that cognitive dissonance that Barbie is working through, Ken is experiencing it too. And I think he only recognizes it as a form of cognitive dissonance there at the end. But we don't get that journey of working through it and coming out the other side with a clear path forward. What we get, if we get anything at the end, if we get a little bit of growth, then it's the recognition that he too, even when he has access to power and privilege, when he feels that Kingdom is enabling him to be something more, it's only at the end there that he can admit that, well, he's also restricted. There are also restrictions placed on him, which is the state of men under patriarchy. Like, sure, we have access to power and privilege, but only for so long as we abide by its rules. Only so long as we stay in that very tightly scrutinized category of proper masculine man. If we venture beyond that, if we decide to use that power in some sort of liberatory fashion, then we risk losing access to all of it. This is something that I am incredibly cognizant of in my teaching, something that I try to be cognizant of in other work that I do, where it's I want to show men that, you know, we can push the boundaries, that, you know, we can take on roles and qualities and develop abilities that are more commonly associated with women, with femininity, while also knowing that if I push some people too hard too fast, then I will lose my authority in their eyes. It will go from here. Look, we can expand what is possible, what is permissible. We can welcome in other aspects of humanity that aren't commonly associated with men. I can make masculinity a little bigger for them. But if it's like, no, we got to explode the whole thing, we got to start over from scratch, people will shut down. They'll shut down and they'll say like, no, oh, I get it. You're a lunatic. All right, bye. And so at the end of the Barbie movie, I think, you know, Ken is still coming to terms with defining the problem. And you know, I think that's probably one of the reasons that so many people were eager for a sequel. Because like, okay, so what does tomorrow look like for Ken? Because we don't know.
Yeah, because we know he has the shirt that says I'm Ken enough, Kenuff. yeah. But what does that mean in his head? And as I actually asked Alyssa to pause the movie so I could like speak a thought out loud, not even necessarily to communicate it to her, but to communicate it to myself to see how it, like, I think I, whenever I shoot my videos, I end up shooting them almost always twice because the idea has to, I have to hear my own idea out loud. And when he was like, there is no Ken without Barbie. And then she's like, no, there's Ken and there is Barbie and there is Ken. And then he like gets validation of his role. And then he like goes and like bends her over to kiss her again. And she's like, no. And that was the moment I asked Alyssa to pause. And I said, what I think he's experiencing is he's like a mime bouncing off the walls of, I think what's been, I don't know if this is a popular term, but it seems to be the man box of like the different possible roles you can be as a man. And one of the things I experienced, which feels like maybe an odd parallel, but a little over a year ago, my hair was growing out and I wanted to let it grow out. Part of it is that our daughter now has like some pretty decently long hair. She's 2.5 and I didn't know how to take care of it. It was getting to the length that my understanding as a short-haired person for all my life was no longer sufficient to take care of it. And so I said to Alyssa, like, I think I want to grow it out so I can better understand like how to take care of long hair, like what the experience is like. At least like I don't have to do this forever, but like I'm happy to go through a phase for a learning process and empathetic process. And she's like, that's a stupid reason to grow out your hair. And I was like, maybe. She's like, why do you really want to grow out your hair? And I was like, she's like, how do you want it? And I was like, honestly, I want it in a way that I know how to take care of it, but like I only know how to take care of it because I was never introduced to another way. So I don't know if I like long hair. I just have no experience with it. And that's what I've always been told. And it was like, almost felt like a moment of seeing the man box, choosing to pass through its walls of like, I'm going to try out long hair because I want to try out long hair, not because it's a feminine thing, not because of any other reason, but because I've never tried it. And it was, I'm grateful that phase is over. I'm back to short hair now. It's much more efficient and easier to manage. And it's a not that funny of a reason, but we ended up slicking it back. So we're going to take like family pictures. It's like, you can't hide it with a backwards hat like you always do. So I had these like mid-range ones right here. And she's like, we got to do something about that. So we slicked it back so it looked like the eventual goal, which was to have a ponytail. And I saw it and I had like a call that night while it was slicked back. And I was like, I look like a 1990s like teenage villain with like with like a L.L. Bean shirt like around my waist. And I was like, nope, I'm done with that. I'm glad that I got to fast forward 2 months by slicking it back, attempting a family picture.
Looked too much like one of those villains saying that there's no place for your kind at our country club.
Yeah, I think it reminds me of like Power Rangers from the 1990s with like Tony the Green Ranger, or like who are those guys? From like from Hocus Pocus, the two guys that like steal the main character's shoes. I think they all had like long hair and ponytails, but yeah. Neil, I know you talked about possibly writing a book, and that's of interest to you. It's something that you may or may not be working on. One, what can people expect? But two, like, what's, tell us a little bit about the vision behind it. Obviously there's a market for it, because your content's been doing so well, but like, why do you think there's a market for it?
So I receive a lot of unsolicited DMs from people who just feel like they don't know where to turn, who to turn to for help. Now, in some cases, there are a few different kinds of people, I'll say, who send me these DMs. A small number of them are boys and men between the ages of 16 and 20. Oftentimes they'll say, look, I think that my politics are feminist. You know, I want to be a better friend and a better ally to the girls and the women that I know. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to support them. I also don't know how to push back against men who are calling me names for it or who have targeted me for it. And so they're like, you know, whatever you can give me, whatever sort of advice or resources you can direct me to, like, please. I also get quite a few messages. The majority of messages, in fact, are from women who either have a partner or they have children who they feel are well-intentioned, who are trying to do the right thing, are trying to do right by them, but they need a little bit of direction too. And, you know, I do my best to share resources with them. Unfortunately, with my particular background, a lot of those resources are more academic than what they would like. What they want is, you know, they want the equivalent, the male feminist equivalent to something like a Jordan Peterson book that says, hey, here are 12 rules to live by. This is how you should operate as you move through the world. And this is why.
I have a decent book that might be good for, it's not Jordan Peterson. It's, are you familiar with Liz Plank?
I follow her on social media.
I got the privilege of meeting her the other day. Kristen Bell connected me with her.
Cool.
But you know, she wrote the For the Love of Men, which of the books that I've been reading in the past like 2 years or so, a lot of them have been very much about like the challenge of being women within patriarchy, and she does a really good job, I think, diving into the challenges of being a man in the patriarchy. She does get pretty academic in nature. Like, I listen to her book and I already feel shameful about the book that I'm working on, with the level of detail she goes into, and her resources and her citations. But I've found that that has been a really good one. Simple things like a couple like stories that I remember really well is there was a trans man who had lost like a loved one, went to their funeral and like got far less like hugs and affection and like empathy from the people around them because they were a man. Or like, what was the other one? Is that and no, this is how I always preface my stats and quotes in podcasts, because I know I'm going to get it wrong. As I say, I know I'm going to get the stat wrong. I remember being wowed by it, and don't trust the number, but trust that there's some level of wow factor around it. Is something like maybe double the amount of men are more likely to go homeless than women because of their fear to like reach out to the people around them. something like that. It was in one of the earlier chapters, but I felt like I would recommend as a resource, that's been a pretty good one for me to come to grips with the challenge of being a man in society. And she cites, like, I think there was a couple NFL players that were gay and like the challenges that they had of like being the first openly gay men in the NFL. So if they're looking for a book and a little bit less academic, that's where I'd recommend they go.
Yeah. My go-to recommendations tend to be bell hooks, precisely because bell hooks of, even though she was herself an academic, she avoids filling her books with citations and references that she feels like can get in the way. And even signal to readers that, you know, maybe this isn't for you. So she tries to be far more inclusive and accessible in that way.
Bell hooks. That's wait, don't tell me. I haven't read it yet, but I think it's in my Audible library somewhere, is The Will to Change.
Yep. Yeah. So that would be sort of recommendation number one most of the time. And it's funny because as I think about this book and I have a lot of notes, I have an outline, I have to put aside my distaste, like my knee-jerk distaste for like the self-help category. Because, you know, there is so much bad stuff in those books. So many books that look like they were written to like exploit vulnerable groups, right? But there's a reason why it appeals to people, why solution-oriented books like the self-help category are what people reach for. And as much as my own inclination is to, okay, no, I start with the background. I have to establish the existence of the problem, and I have to tell you why the problem exists, the various factors that need accounting for, before we can get into, okay, what are the concrete constructive steps that we can take to remedy that problem? If I want to reach the people who have been reaching out to me, I have to reorient myself. It's like, okay, no, I'm going to lead with solutions. And then I'll establish, you know, okay, what got me here? What was the problem that we need to address, and why does it exist? Because that sort of solution forward approach is what people really badly need. And if we're not offering that, what happens is that they go somewhere else, and they go to somebody like a Jordan Peterson, which is the last person that I want them reaching for.
Like adamantly crystalled and found pain in hearing really anything they heard from Donald Trump or Jordan Peterson, and their coach recommended reading their books just so that they could like fully understand like the level of like what they're trying to talk about. And like, just their coach also challenged them to, if they had a fear of sharks, to go swim with sharks. So it was interesting enough to hear that, but I'm curious, have you dove into Jordan Peterson's work at all? I have not.
I've read parts of, you know, his big book, the 12 Rules to Live By. I've read pages of it. I could not bring myself to consume more than like two pages in a single sitting. He has this rhetorical approach that seems to be characteristic of propagandists, honestly, which is one of the reasons why I recoil against this style of writing, where he opens with a truism of some kind that honestly nobody can argue with, or that it's very difficult to argue with. And that's how he gets the buy-in. So, you know, he's 12 rules to live by. He has one that's like, always clean your room or keep your room clean. It's like, okay, you know, I can't see any reason to say like, absolutely not. No, we should all live in mess. Chaos is wonderful. It's like, oh, there are always exceptions, but generally speaking, keep your room clean is good advice. And so the,
sounds like a Trojan horse for like some like deeper seated BS that comes after it.
Exactly. And so, and that is his rhetorical style. I'm going to start with something that you should agree with. Like, who could possibly disagree with me here? And then you get, you know, 1,000 words in, and, you know, you've been nodding along to start, and he ever so slightly keeps pushing toward a takeaway that is very different than where we started. But, you know, it's like, okay, if you agree with premise A, then let me introduce an analogy. Like, isn't it a lot like this other thing? And if you can follow me along that path, then let me take you to, and like, wait, whoa, how did we get here? And that's the sort of thing that I feel like I can recognize with like the background and the training that I have. But I know that this book is very popular among 13-year-old boys. And are they just eating it up?
I knew that his book was popular, probably a bestseller, but like, I didn't realize that it was like popular among that age group. That's, I don't know really any of the things in the book. I've watched enough of his like content and people reacting to it to have a feel for it, but that terrifies me a little bit.
He and Andrew Tate, I didn't have a great understanding of just how popular they are among like middle schoolers, until talking to my daughter about it. When she, there's a, you know, a graduation ceremony for eighth grade, and, each of the students were asked to choose an inspirational quote. The two most popular people for boys to quote were Andrew Tate and Jordan Peterson.
Dear God.
And you know, you see their name appear once. There was a slideshow at the ceremony. And it's like, whoa, that I didn't expect that. And then it happens again and again and again. And I sat down with her afterward and I'm like, they are really popular, aren't they? And she was saying like, oh, all the boys love talking about Andrew Tate. They Andrew Tate is their hero. What? And like, of course, I knew that, like, obviously their audiences are mostly men and they are mostly younger men. I didn't think that their penetration was reaching kids that were that young.
Wow.
And so, like, the need... for somebody,
yeah, what the fuck? This was supposed to be fun podcast. Now I'm just like disturbed.
Right. Yeah. The need then to have messaging that is as accessible to people that age is actually really dire.
Hmm.
We need people who can also reach 13-year-old boys.
Since talking with your daughter about that, have you come to any conclusions or hypotheses around why you think their message resonates down to such a young age?
I mean, the can't discount the fact that, you know, they make what they talk about seem really cool. You know, whether that is the way that they style themselves. You know, we have two different extremes of like. Peterson talks very openly about the performance of his outfits, that he wears increasingly garish and over the top, like bespoke suits. which is its own display of this like excessive, sort of like the same sort of fantasy that I can imagine a 13-year-old boy having, where it's like, oh, hell yeah, if I have to dress up, I am also going to wear this red and blue asymmetric metallic suit. That looks badass. It's dressed up, but it's not what my dad would wear. It's not what my mom would want me to wear. Or, you know, Andrew Tate bragging about what he does with his fleet of cars, smoking cigars. And I think the less said, the better about him. But I can see just that superficial appeal that they hold, to say nothing of the fact that, you know, what I always say about the Manosphere in general and folks like Peterson and Tate in specific, is that they are tremendously good at stoking fear, at taking something that is actually rather mundane and commonplace, like standard anxieties around puberty and coming of age, something like, you know, hey, it's difficult for me to talk to girls, and spinning that into a conspiracy that women have against men like you, against boys like you. It's not that it is difficult at 13 for a pubescent straight boy to talk to a girl that he has a crush on. It is that the woke mob, led by radical feminists, is creating a world where you are not allowed to talk to girls. That's what it is. What you are butting up against is a movement designed to deny you the ability to talk to girls at all. And we have to destroy it.
Rather than just calling out, it's like, I mean, I still recall eighth grade going to talk to this girl, Rebecca, and I was shaking with my pen in my yearbook saying, will you sign it? And I was like, literally shaking in my shoes, but it was just a matter of confidence. I mean, I think I hit my stride in high school and college and like figured out how to talk to women, but
you've identified the problem right there, where you're like, it was my confidence level, you know, and my comfort level. And that's something that I would need to develop, you know, through an iterative process. I have to accept that I am nervous. So I talk to this girl and another, and I receive feedback and I grow and I learn. But it's so much easier if somebody says, no, actually it's a conspiracy that is out to get you and people like you. It's not you.
You don't have to do any work if it's external. They're the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to work on anything. What we have to do is take them down.
Yeah, how do you have the tallest tower in the city? You can either build the tallest tower or you can shatter the rest of them that are taller than yours.
Absolutely.
Wow, Neil, you're really making me rethink my whole platform. I just went full-time recently and I'm thinking maybe I need to ditch Mentalo and just talk about positive masculinity for 13-year-olds. I know I can't do that, but like, it feels tempting to pivot that way now.
I mean, the mental load, obviously huge part of the discussion anyway. I would never want you to pivot away from that.
All right. You manage the confidence for the 13-year-old boys. I'll work on the mental load.
There's so much, right? There are so many, there's so many different problems that need addressing, that need champions to take them on. And I think what you're describing actually is when you're like, well, whew, now should I be talking about this too? This is a problem that I run into too, where there are videos that I make and I've set myself these strict 3-minute limits in part because it helps me maintain focus. I can't talk about it all. It is so tempting to talk about everything, but it's not realistic. It's not realistic to put that on myself. It's not realistic for me to expect, especially on platforms where people are expecting short form videos. It's not realistic for me to expect somebody's going to sit through that and actually resonate with, much less absorb, my attempt to talk about absolutely everything. It's a problem that I have to fight in my teaching too. You know, if I have 2 hours to talk to a group of students, I'm also tempted to talk about everything. And instead it's like, no, you know, I can do justice to these three things. I'm going to talk about three things. Same thing with a 3-minute video. Like I can feel pretty good about this one issue. Let's focus on this one issue.
I have two questions for you to finish up here. One is, you know, from a content creator's perspective, I watch your videos and I can't help but even first think about the workflow of how you do it, versus like, I know most people just dive into like what you're talking about. I'm watching how you do it. I'm curious, from the time that you see the video that you have a good idea that you're okay, I'm going to make a hit me with it, to it being published and done, I'm betting it takes you 45 minutes. It probably starts with a tag, or probably you're not seeing a scroll, but you're probably getting one or two tags or DM. Neil, please comment on this one. You take a look at it. Yep, I like this. You download it. You find the first like hook clip that you're doing the pink stitch incoming. You come up with your first line. And then as you're watching the video, you're looking for that second or third hit from that person that you're going to speak to further. Is 45 minutes accurate?
It depends. A lot, and to a significant degree, what it depends on is whether the topic is familiar enough that I can actually find what I know I need, do the homework to back me up. Sometimes I can do that in a matter of minutes, you know, because it's like, okay, I know exactly where I need to go to find what I'm looking for. There are some instances where it begins, you know, much the same way that you described it at the beginning of this conversation, where it's like, that doesn't feel right. I'm pretty sure that they're wrong, but I'm going to have to dig around for it. So that research end of things can take a little more time, depending. But there are certainly times where, you know, somebody sends me a video, I'm like, oh, this absolutely. And I know what I'm going to say. I save it. I cut it up into chunks. I get my notebook out and I break it down segment by segment. I don't break down what I'm going to say. I have like a few keywords for each segment. And then I will go through, I'll throw the research up behind me when it feels like it's needed. And then record, you know, the separate segments for each response to their segment. And that on the short end would be 30 to 45 minutes. But if it requires a little more work on the back end, then it can go over an hour.
Yeah, one of the ways. I feel like I'm unwilling to take more than like, I don't know. So if I'm doing like a collaboration with someone else, I'll take like the time that it takes to make it good. But for the most part, I'm like unwilling to spend more than like 30 minutes on a video, I think. Unless I like have a really big vision for like what it could do. Like there was one that was really cool. I feel like the nerd in you, cause I know you talk about a lot of kind of nerdy things. Have you seen the video? I think your name's El Cordova. She has a conversation between the different fonts.
So oh, like yes.
Helvetica, or Ariel has a crush on Helvetica. I decided I was like, I want to make just a small series just to see how they do of like emotional labor, talking to mental load, talking to blue collar work, talking to white collar work. I feel like there's some good potential there. So like that was one that I gave time to, but my everyday example of mental loads, like I refuse to mm-hmm. take more than 20 minutes. Oftentimes I'm like, all right, did I say anything offensive? Check. No, no, nothing offensive. Does it generally get the point home? Eh, kind of. Fuck it. We're at 20 minutes. Like I'm done. Post.
So, Ed, so that's, I think that's how personally I manage some of these labor and time intensive videos, by offsetting them with something that is shorter, snappier, doesn't require that background work. Like I recorded a video yesterday where I worried that it's a little too inside, but I stitched somebody who is complaining that the Barbie movie makes fun of men. But this is already a trend where you snip all of the context, and it's become a thing now where you just keep, men are stupid, useless, creepy, or evil, without that being a complaint that she's making yeah. the movie. And so I stitched that, and you know, I threw up a picture behind me that had Jordan Peterson, Andrew Tate, Elon Musk, and Donald Trump. And I turned it into,
I think I saw that one. That
yeah, riffing on the opening credits to Avatar. And I'm like, oh, this is great, low effort, funny. So yeah, it's a few of those lower effort, less time videos. And then I feel, you know, okay, well, I'm willing to sit now with this Hit Me With It video that will take time and will take work. Because I feel like I gave myself the gift of time with this video that took me 5 minutes.
I have two questions that I want to ask, but I think I want you to choose which one you want to answer, and we'll have that be the final one. So I'm going to give you two options. One, okay. So I was a teacher for 8 years. I was a content creator for 5 or 6 of those. So the first option question is, how has becoming a known content creator impacted your job and like your relationship with your students and or the response from your faculty? And two, I think I just lost it.
Hey, that's okay, because that's a great,
we're going to stick with that first right one.
There. Yeah. You know, it seems to be, it's less meaningful to my students than I actually thought it would be. It is rarely mentioned to me unless I make reference to it first. In fact, I'm trying to remember whether any of my students have ever made mention of it before I do. I did have a funny situation where somebody was referring to me as Professor Neil. It's like, oh, I introduced myself like just as Neil. I'm like, hey, call me Neil. Like, I don't think I've ever referred to myself as Professor Neil. Like, I wonder where that came
from. And so you're wondering if they're quoting you from like,
yeah,
your presence on social media.
So it, like, is it just that it's awkward or it's strange to admit to the person teaching you that like that you recognize them? Like, maybe that's it. You know, it's isn't this like a very universal thing? Like, the your teacher doesn't exist for you outside of the classroom.
Outside of the classroom, right? Yeah.
You run into them at the grocery store, and like, this is really unsettling. Why are you here? So
broke
maybe
the
it's
fourth
a
wall.
Bit,
how dare yeah, you?
Absolutely, yes. So I think it might be a little bit of that they just would not tell me if they had seen me. So it hasn't really had an effect there. It has had more of an effect professionally, because coworkers, administrators, are much more willing to say like, oh, hey, I saw a video of yours. What's up with that? I recently had a meeting with like the provincial president of my union, you know, it was like 200,000 members. It was like, oh, hey, I saw some of your videos. Can we talk about them? So the way that it then You know, we have these relationships. It does a lot to close the distance between somebody who otherwise I don't know and I've never spoken to. You know, the director of international at my college came up to me after meeting recently. He's like, we need to sit down and talk about sociology. It's like, I love your videos. I want to talk to you about it. Never had a conversation with this person before. But already he feels like, hey, there's something that we need to talk about.
It's almost like by putting videos out there, it's a bid for connection to the world. And so people that are in your, you know, physical environment, like, are seeing them and thinking of it as like, oh, he's putting out this free information, a piece of himself. And like, he's, you know, he's giving the public the opportunity to talk on it. And so that's like, that's an easy line that I can grab onto and form a relationship with this person.
Yeah.
I never thought of it quite like that until now, but that's a good point.
And we often talk about like parasocial relationships as if they are uniformly bad, right? That you're exposed.
What's a parasocial relationship?
A parasocial relation. I'm so glad that you asked, and now I'm worried that we're going a little long, but I'll try to make it brief. Parasocial relationship is an entirely one-way relationship between an audience and an artist or a content creator. So you see somebody on a screen, and you see them regularly. You feel like you know them. You even have an emotional connection to their presence. But that person on the screen, not only do they not know you, they don't even know you exist. And so parasocial relationships, think of celebrities and fans. You know, fans have a tremendous investment in that actor or that character that the actor can't even reciprocate. They're not aware of you. And to the extent that they do acknowledge you, it's like we're talking about a difference of several magnitudes in familiarity and intensity. And the focus in, for instance, something like fan studies, which is where most of the discussions of parasocial relationships emerged, at least, you know, in the scholarship, parasociality is often described as like something that should concern us. Like, we derive benefits from it, definitely. The reason that we are fans of particular people is because it's satisfying. We get enjoyment. We find communities of other people who enjoy parasocial relationships to that property. But we have real community. We have real relationships with other fans. But that parasocial one, it's touchy because you do, in some cases, you know, you have an emotional connection to a character that is not even real. So it goes beyond the actor, the real person. But now it's just a performance. And what happens if they let you down? What happens if, you know, that character ceases to exist? What now? And we know that it can be pathological.
That reminds me of, so, I mean, I'm sure you know by now, so I offer services to work with men to help better understand mental load. And oftentimes, like, I'll get on a call, the guy will be like, yeah, I'm pretty interested. I think I need to talk to my wife about this. I'm like, sure, that's great. Let's schedule a follow-up call. Would you like your wife to join? And I, since most of the guys that find me have already been sent my videos to them from their wife, so I know that their wives are already aware of my existence. And I remember one time being sad that a guy's like, oh no, she doesn't want to do that. She said something about like, never meet your idols, or something like that. And I was like,
sure.
I think what was being pointed to is she didn't want to break the parasocial relationship that she has with me, and possibly breaking that positive experience and finding out I'm some different version of what she had hoped.
Absolutely. So yeah, you're getting at like how complex parasocial relationships can be here. And there may in fact be very good reasons that we want to maintain the distance of a parasocial relationship. You know, precisely for that reason, we don't want to be disappointed. A significant amount of attention that's paid to parasociality is when it turns pathological, when it turns into stalking, obsession. Whether that stalking is online or even in person, and, you know, can result in violence. But parasociality has, you know, these good things too, where it and I say good from my end, because often for the content creator, the parasocial relationship is like a tremendous source of anxiety. You know, I am very aware now, particularly when I'm in large cities, that I am moving through a space where I am encountering multiple people in a day who recognize me, who know me. And not only do I not know them, but I don't know who they are, except through like little micro cues in a lot of cases. I was in Manhattan a couple of months ago. I went for a walk, and twice I got the exact same double take from two different people. And it was that look,
because they thought they saw James Vanderbeek.
Well, they certainly thought they saw somebody they knew. And so I got like the oh, hey, and then they pulled it back. Because in 2 seconds, it looked like they ran through the process of, hey, you're familiar, I like you. Oh, shit, I just remembered why I recognize you. You have no idea who I am. I'm going to keep walking and pretend that never happened.
Wow. I got recognized four times. I've been recognized, I think, four or five times in the past 6 months. And like someone, the coolest one was my friend kept telling me I was famous. And I was like, I haven't been recognized in public yet. Or like, it just happened like a coincidence. I was wearing my exact outfit that one of my viral videos and I was in public. And like, I told him this like 10 minutes before we stepped out. As we're stepping out, we've been outside of this door for 5 seconds. This girl walking by just looks at me like, hey, Zach, I really like your videos. Keep making them. Like, just walks by and like acknowledges my existence. Like, she didn't even change the cadence of her step. But I walk around like, I made a video recently how I was on an ego trip the other day. Cause I was like, I don't have merch, but like I have things to identify me with. Mm-hmm. And I was in Austin, Texas. So I was like, all right, I can get recognized in my home state. How famous is 350,000 followers on Instagram? Like, do people like, would someone recognize me? So I had my shirt that said Recovering Man Child on it, and I walked around, probably looked a little dumb with my chest puffed out, hoping someone would recognize me, honestly. And I was just so curious as to if someone would notice me. I have not experienced what you just described, which is someone does a double take and you can watch in real time them saying, wait a second, this is a parasocial experience.
Yeah.
They don't know me. Okay, I'm not talking. And Alyssa tells me all the time, sure, four or five people have acknowledged you and thanked you for your videos. How many are not saying anything? And that's what I would love to know.
Let me tell you a story, and I don't know if you want to wrap it up after this. I can tell you a story about this. I was in LA last summer. My wife and I and my daughter went to an improv show. And I would have left that show telling you, oh, you know, nobody recognized me. But as my wife was standing in line for the washroom, or I should say bathroom, I only recently learned that washroom is a Canadianism. So she's standing in line for the bathroom, and she hears over her shoulder somebody say, oh, that's him sitting right over there. And I think his wife is with him. I saw her too. And she only overheard it because they didn't know that she was in earshot. They never said anything to me. There was no acknowledgement. And yet that conversation is occurring. And not only did they recognize me, they recognized her. And that is in one of those moments where I'm like, you know, this sounds like it was just positive. Sounded like it was a discussion between to people who know me and like me. God forbid it should ever be a conversation between people who know me and dislike me. Alyssa is absolutely right. This is happening. People are recognizing you. And they, I think, wisely recognize that it would be too weird to tell you that. Although that said, I did have one day where two people introduced themselves to me within 5 minutes of each other.
Wow.
And the first had not seen, or the second had not seen the first person do it. So it was just two people who were like, oh, hey, you're that guy from the internet. I love your videos. some people have that.
I fully welcome it. When you say that you know, they don't want to interact with you wisely, why do you think that that's wise for them?
You know, I say that wisely, not because I would be offended in any way. Mm-hmm. I like that we are at a point, though, where people can recognize, and, you know, maybe this is also because it's LA and, you know, somebody that you recognize from a screen is a dime a dozen there. But they recognize the possibility that somebody could have a boundary there, that they could react poorly. And so for their own sake, I can appreciate that they would want to play it safe. So not introduce yourself to somebody who is at a show that you have all paid to access, who is there with his family too. I wouldn't react poorly, but I can absolutely imagine a world in which somebody would. And better safe than sorry, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it sounds like you're a more humble person than I am. I'm all for people approaching me and taking selfies with me and tagging me in it. The one thing I've noticed is all the time, like, I'll even be, I have this consistent curiosity similar to this of like, if I'm walking by, you know, 10 moms in a supermarket, I'm thinking there's my views overall. Like if I counted all of them up, I think they're somewhere between like 60 or 70 to 100 million views. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure the odds are they've at least seen my face before. They might not follow me, but they've probably seen my face once before. And I've sort of tested this theory out whenever, like, I went to VCon last year, mm-hmm. Gary Vaynerchuk's conference, and there are a couple of promoters there, found out they were moms. And I was like, yeah, like, I make these videos about X, Y, and Z, which I was at a third of the following that I'm currently at. And they're like, oh, wait, yeah, I've seen you before. So I think a lot of people I'm so curious as to like how many people have actually seen me before. And I don't know how much of that is curiosity for, you know, my human curiosity's sake versus like my ego wants to know how famous I am.
Hey, you know, I'm not going to make it. I don't want to give the impression that, you know, I am not curious about this either. That I don't find it really fascinating. And fun. Honestly, it's fun when somebody is like, oh, hey, I recognize you, I love your videos. I like the fact that I am aware that there are people that recognize me and think, you know, I don't want to run the risk that I am harassing somebody. So I'm going to be hands off just as a rule. Which I do think is probably a good approach in general. I will also add here that when I'm out, I rarely wear my glasses. If I did like want to indicator. Be recognized, yeah. If you know, so if I go to a conference in the future, I'm going to be wearing these. I'll make a point. Like I know that it's one of like my signature visual elements, right?
Yeah.
So I do wonder if part of it is 99% of the videos that I post to Instagram and TikTok, I'm wearing the glasses.
Yeah.
If I were wearing them every moment in public, you know, would I actually get a lot more
attention. Yeah, how many more clicks would you get in person, right? Yeah, and similarly, yeah. Like I wear this hat. I feel like by now I've worn this in probably, I don't know, maybe one or 200 videos by now, that I feel like this is my most recognizable like thing. But you know, fun fact was that I worked for a software company. Mm-hmm. I met this guy in person that, you know, I had been on Zoom calls with here and there for a couple months. I gave him a hug when I met him. Hey, Kevin, good to see you. Gave him a hug. He told me 3 weeks later when we were on a Zoom call again, he's like, Zach, I had no idea who was hugging me. You were taller than I realized you were. And I was like, who the fuck just hugged me?
I had that thought actually when you said you were 6'5". I'm like, I wonder if the height throws people.
Yeah. I think there have been a couple of videos where I'm like standing in like a doorway or next to a fridge and they're like, oh, wait a second. Like, how tall are you?
I can only imagine, like, I'm 6'1", and a couple of times meeting people in person, they've commented on how I'm like, I'm just a bigger human being than they were expecting.
Hmm.
So yeah, 6'5", that is certainly enough to pose some recognition problems, I'm sure.
Yeah. So I actually am going to ask the last question, but I know that there might not be a full answer to it. I figured out what it was.
Okay.
Is you're thinking about a book. I know you don't have any like free offers besides, you know, your very frequent, almost daily content. What can people expect from you in the future? I think the 13-year-olds need a better book. Not to say I'm sure Bell Hooks is great, but I'm also wondering if Neil Shuminsky might be pretty decent author for them. What can people expect from you?
You know what? I don't have a lot of specific plans, in part because there's a baby showing up in 3 months. You know, how much can I commit to when I don't know how much of my time is going to be available, frankly. So aside from this book that I'm working on in the background, I think that I might be like fully committed right there. You know, work, the videos that I make, book, baby. And then I still have to like fit time in for my family beyond that. Time for myself. So I think that this next year at least is going to be incredibly jam-packed just trying to keep my head above water. So no great reveals of new projects or plans. But there might be a bit of a shift in the videos that I am putting out there. Probably more videos where I have like a baby napping on my shoulder or something like that. Right.
Yeah.
I've noticed that Pearl Mania now has many videos where he's just holding the baby, talking to his phone.
Who? The
baby's turned away. He's a political content creator mostly. Pearl Mania. He spends a lot of time like shouting about what's happening in politics. Gets like progressively worked up. And he'll have like his partner is like asking him questions off screen. So he's bouncing off of her, riffing on what she's giving him. It's a very funny dynamic.
Well, my invitation for you from what we've said here is that I think I'm imagining you have a mostly woman audience. Mm-hmm. I think you should consider making a 2-page PDF on how you might recommend or book recommendations along with how you might recommend moms talk to their 12-year-old boys. I think that would be, if that might end up being the audience that your book might receive, I think that'd be a good way to, you know, from a marketing standpoint. And I know you made that post the other day, I think from what Carly Waters had referenced it of like, publishers are expecting you to be an entrepreneur, not just a writer, which I've been keyed into for about the past 4 or 5 months and started trying to build my email list and trying to just have like take some of my frequently asked DM questions off my hands as well, and just being able to say, hey, there's a very in-depth answer, 6 pages worth actually, for the question you're asking right now. So Neil, thank you so much for coming on. I'm glad that our parasocial relationship has evolved into a regular, possibly friendship. I've really enjoyed the time with you here today, and you did not break any odd barriers. You're pretty much what I was expecting.
You know what? It's funny. I've received that feedback before. People are like, "Oh wow, you're exactly what I imagined from the videos." I think that's a good thing. So yeah. I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah. Versus like what I hear is that Johnny Depp is, people do not have a great experience meeting him for the first time. He's very much not, was it Jack Sparrow at all in person? All right. Well, people, if you're still listening an hour and a half in, you can find him, Professor_Neil on Instagram or Professor Neil on TikTok. Thank you again for coming.